Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today are Lynn Blackman, who's Director of Communications for the Johnson Collection up in Spartanburg, and Martha Severins, who's contributor to a new publication of the Johnson Collection entitled Central to Their Lives, Southern Women Artists in the Johnson Collection. And on the telephone from Denver, Colorado, is Susanna Johnson Shannon, who is a curatorial advisor to the Johnson Collection and author of the introduction to this publication. So, welcome to the journal, all of you.
Thank you.
Susanna, if you would you give us some background about the Johnson Collection, how it came about with your mom and dad, but particularly with your mom, and what the goal is?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So my father was a history major at Wofford College, and my mother was an English major at Commerce College, both in Spartanburg. And while their careers took different tracks, they both always had a deep love of history and a sense of place, whether it be Spartanburg, South Carolina, where my dad was raised, or Morganton, North Carolina, where my mom was raised. My entire childhood, they loved telling stories about where they were from and different family members, and then visiting different places throughout North and South Carolina. And I think art evolved as a natural way for them to really share this representation of where they were from. My whole childhood, they were interested in art, but it was really when I was in high school and college in the early 2000s when they started purchasing art in a more significant way, typically representations from areas where they had spent time, whether it be Blowing Rock or the coast of South Carolina. And simultaneously, I was pursuing an art history degree at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. And I came home from school and saw the number of paintings they had started to acquire, and wall space was no longer available, and things were in storage rooms. And we started having long conversations about what was the best way to use this art and to really share it. And I think that started the thought in their heads of forming the Johnson Collection and really focusing on the scholarship part of it and the shared history of both of them being from North and South Carolina, and then the broader Southeast, and that this was really an area in American art that had not had a lot of attention in recent history. And my mom in particular has just always loved art, loved supporting emerging artists, and of course she's always been a champion for women, which is leads us to Central to Their Lives.
Lynn, your role with the foundation and the collection?
Well, I feel like I've got the best job in the world, Walter, because I've had the privilege of being a part of something that is truly given as a gift. The Johnson Collection is a beautiful snowflake, to use some millennial terminology. It's an unusual organization that at its heart seeks to be an inspiration by making art widely available to every type of person, not just people who would typically describe themselves as museum goers, and also to support scholarship by incredible veterans in the field like Martha, whose list of publications is long, as well as the opportunity to support new and emerging scholars who have a tough time getting their work and getting work published.
Martha Severins is a longtime guest on our show, even before she started collaborating with the Johnson Collection. And Martha, you wrote, I would say, the defining essay in this book, which explains what it's all about, especially the difficulties of women in the art world. I'm afraid historically people go, oh, women go back to Henrietta Johnson. They were doing those little pastels and those nice miniatures, and then they were all taught to draw along with sew. So weren't they artists back then?
Well, not quite. The beauty of Henrietta Johnston is that she was a professional, meaning that she took money for what she did and she supported her family. So that's sort of a distinction. Not that all of the women in Central to the Lives depended or defined themselves in terms of their income, though I think almost all, maybe there's one exception, did manage to sell their work. And that exception, of course, is an interesting story. But let me talk a little bit about my essay and what my assignment was. As we sat around the table planning and who we might invite to be the other essayists and the topics we were covering in those essays. Topics kept cropping up that weren't going to be covered. And so Martha's assignment was to just collect them all. And I forget what term we used, but it was sort of like, you know, I got to package the whole thing. And I think I did a draft and had not included photography. And so we decided that I should include photography because there are some very strong women photographers who came to the South, and that made an interesting...
Allman immediately comes
to mind. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So it was a way to include Zelda Fitzgerald, for instance, Helen Dupre Mosley. I wanted to include George O'Keefe, who's not in the collection. So my essay does include a couple of things, illustrations we procured from the Gibbs Museum and the Greenville Museum. I wanted to include Annie Elbers, who was at Black Mountain College with her husband and a very important force up there. So it was a kind of catch-all essay. I would have wanted more illustrations. I had a longer list, but of course, you know, reality set in, and so we couldn't manage them all.
And so some of the illustrations are from other collections, but at the end you have the artwork that is going to be on display. Lynn, the exhibit opened in Athens, and where's it going to travel to from that?
Well, we're so pleased that this museum opened it, that the Georgia Museum, who has been a great partner to the collection, and of course Bill Island, a longtime colleague mm-hmm. of Martha's, and a real advocate for women artists. He was very encouraging to us as the project was put together. From Athens, it traveled to Mississippi Museum of Art in Jackson, where it currently is, and it proceeds on from there to five additional museums. We're really thrilled that of the seven museums it's traveling to, four are in new states for the Johnson Collection to be represented in. And it will finally, in the midst of that 3.5-year tour, come home to South Carolina when it will be at the Gibbs Museum in Charleston in the first half of 2020, from January through May of 2020.
Okay. Let's back up to the book. Did it start out just as a catalog, or is it really meant to be an art history book? And I'm going to throw that one to you, Martha.
You saw me shaking my head. It's absolutely got long shelf life. It is a major publication on women artists of the South. And the fact that it has these six very cogent essays, I'm including myself in that count, so maybe five other wonderful essays, as well as comprehensive catalog entries, and then this incredible directory that the Johnson Collection has put together with the 2,000-some names of women artists who have worked in the South, born in the South, and this is the magnum opus of one of the staff members at the Johnson Collection, Holly Waters, who should get a great, salute in terms of the work that she did. And what's exciting here is that we all see her directory as foundational. In other words, it's the beginning of a resource on which we can build. So to go back to my initial comment, this book has long shelf life. And the intention, and Lynn, you can help me out here, is that this information is going to go online so it can be updated and corrected, which is just super. But here it is in print.
And we present it as an incomplete starting point. It is compiled through any number of resources, exhibition records, our own scholarship, the scholarship of art historians who work with us, and it is meant to be a dynamic, living organism. It is posted on our website at thejohnsoncollection.org, and we invite those people who avail themselves of it to please let us know if we have something incorrect or if they can provide us with additional information so that we can be a resource. That's part of the goal. The scholarship that the Johnson Collection seeks to support is not just for today, but also for the future. If we can leave some sort of thread for a future scholar or student to pick up and just carry that ball a little further down the field, that will be very rewarding for us.
Well, why this book on Southern women artists now?
I think it was inevitable that the collection would put forth a book focused on women artists. My mom is the CEO of the Johnson Collection, and it has been her lifelong calling to champion women and support women and teach us all about women, and it was really just the natural progression for a publication for the collection. And with it being published this year, it is very timely with the different movements going on in our country and really in the world, whether it be the Women's March, the Me Too movement. This is really women's time. Lynn mentions in her editorial note the Fearless Girl statue, you know, another piece of artwork, and there's no better time for women to be at the forefront. And in fact, it's high time, and I think this is just a really unique opportunity and a wonderful time for this book to be published.
And in many ways, with it, even though there are lots and lots of illustrations, Martha said there could be more, but it's evident from the ones that are on tour for the exhibit is that the Johnson Collection has been assembling women artists over time. This is not just a one-shot deal.
30% of the artists in the collection are women.
I think there are also logistical concerns, and Lynn and Susanna, you can correct me, that we wanted to get to a critical mass and a quality, and the initial work that we did 4 summers ago for Dave Henderson was to go state by state and to identify all the women artists we could find. And then he and we sort of assessed, we ranked them, if you will, and he went after artists that he felt needed to be in the collection. So it wasn't just, oh, we have 30% of the collection, we need to do something with it. It was a very well thought out project. And it's also, in terms of the chronology of other publications from the Johnson Collection, the first was Romantic Spirits, which is the 19th century component, the more traditional portraits, narrative, history paintings. The second was Scenic Impressions, which are the, what I call, and I, this is not demeaning when I say this, pretty pictures, lovely landscapes, which sort of went up to the 1940s, but now we've sort of moved on, progressed in time, as it were.
And this does come into the 21st century.
The latest work, I would say, is the Kohlmeier 64.
It's in the 60s, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. All right.
And the directory may have also some people who
living
prospered
artists.
into the 21st
Well, I was
century.
Having looked through the directory. That's where my question came. People are going to look, South Carolinians, when they think of artists. We've already talked about Henrietta Johnson. But you get into the 20th century and people begin to think about the Charleston Renaissance, whether we're talking about Elizabeth and Neil Verner, whether talking about Anna Hayward Taylor, and, of course, Alice Smith.
Of course, Alice Smith.
Yes, but for somebody who has looked at their works in museums, the ones you have in the book are not what I would consider typical of them. Was that deliberate?
I think it was an opportunity to show that in both Verner and Smith's case that they had a broader repertoire. The Rice Plantation series at the Gibbs has kind of packaged Alice Smith a little too tightly. And I have boldly said that that's not her best work, that she is much more at ease and much more natural when she's right there in the landscape emotionally. And I think this wonderful, admittedly, it's a dark and moody, unusual in that respect, but I think that is quite wonderful.
In your opening remarks, Martha, you said that there was one woman who didn't need to sell her works, and I'm sure that's Anna Hyde Huntington.
Not a good guess, Walter. Not at all. Anna Hyde Huntington did not marry Archer M. Huntington until she was 47. Until then, she worked very hard, and she earned significant income, and at one point it was $50,000, which at that time was more money than any other woman working in any other profession.
We're talking about pre-World War II, so that's an incredible sum for
yes.
anybody to be
exactly.
earning.
Exactly. Do you want to know who the artist was that I was referring to?
Yes.
And it wasn't quite that she didn't need to make the money. It was that she did not sell her work. And that's an important distinction because it's a very, oh my gosh, this is so antiquated. This is Kate Freeman Clark, okay, who was a very accomplished student of William Merritt Chase. She did impressionistic landscapes. She was from the Deep South and well chaperoned by her mother, who was willing for her daughter to study with Chase up in New York and to attend his summer sessions on Long Island. But her mother, even though she let her daughter exhibit paintings, which were signed Freeman Clark, no Kate, she was allowed to exhibit her paintings, but her mother would not allow her to sell any of her paintings because it was unladylike. Wow.
Well, there are two things that you speak to the times is that she dropped the Kate, and she was not the only woman, whether in literature or art, that had a name that could pass for a man's, and the idea of not being able to, a lady should not be earning
right.
a living.
Selling. And get it, this was Freeman was the name she used, free man. And yet she was not a free woman.
Mm. Walter, another wonderful anecdote about these Southern women and the way they were compensated or not for their work is Enid Yandella, very accomplished sculptor who worked with the White Rabbits in Chicago. She had a tremendous amount of success. And early in her career, right in the late 19th century, when she had begun to receive recognition and remuneration for her excellent work. There's a document that notes a letter from an uncle who said that she had absolutely disgraced the Yandell name as she had accepted a dollar for her work.
Well, that sadly was an attitude that certainly in South Carolina lasted well into the 30s. For example, a woman who graduated number one in her law class in the 1920s, her husband did not allow her to work because that would be, again, he had to support her. So she spent her life doing pro bono work, number one in her class. And we're saying it's a Southern attitude, might have been more prevalent here than elsewhere, but it still was sadly fairly typical. Now, on the other side, what amazed me is the number of young Southern women who not only go north to study, but who end up in Paris or elsewhere on the continent.
It is remarkable. And part of the reason why Southern women went north or went to Paris in particular was that there was very little opportunity for them in the region. And I guess one person that could be considered an exception is Corey McCallum, and I want to go back to a reference. She didn't die until 2009, so we did get her into the 21st century, and she was pretty active until the end. But she went to University of South Carolina, where she studied with some very strong women artists, Catherine Rembert and Catherine Hayward. So there is a tradition there. Of course, she went on to the Boston Museum School following her husband and then eventually returned to Charleston.
And she married William Halsey, right?
Correct. And that brings up another potential topic, is the idea of artistic couples and the balancing act that they did. Halsey and McCallum are a good example of kind of, if I may say, duking it out. And since I knew both of them and witnessed them doing this, it's a kind of interesting dynamic. And I think very clearly he makes a point of going in one direction with his collages and his sculptures, which are very tactile and very dark in many ways. And she goes in another direction, and that is more decorative, more colorful, more brilliant work, as if they are trying to define themselves as separate artists.
We need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm speaking with Lynn Blackman, Susanna Johnson Shannon, and Martha Severins about a new publication from the Johnson Foundation, Central to Their Lives, Southern Women Artists in the Johnson Collection. Let's talk about the opportunities for women to seriously study art and Sophie Newcomb College in New Orleans, which eventually became part of Tulane, was the first.
And that started in the early 20th century. And I think what's remarkable is, first of all, it's a woman's college, and the design, if you will, the mission was to provide women with a skill set that they could earn a living. So, yes, they were kind of slightly leaning to the practical arts of bookbinding and jewelry. And the thing I think that I associate most with Newcomb is Newcomb pottery, that wonderful, and of course there is a pictorial element to the pottery, which captures the flora and fauna of the region. And if I may make a segue, the mover and shaker behind Newcomb College was Ellsworth Woodward, who, of course, also was very important in the Southern States Art League. And the agenda for the Southern States Art League was to promote Southern artists. And of the 1,200 members of the league, two-thirds were women. And you had people like Elizabeth O'Neill Verner in leadership roles. And it was really them who held the league together. And we have a wonderful essay by Karen Claxman addressing specifically the league and the role of women.
Newcomb pottery is, you know, world famous. Just look at the Antiques Roadshow.
Right.
Interestingly, people don't think of the University of South Carolina as a hotbed for art instruction. But yet, before World War II, it was very, very strong. And Martha, I know you've already mentioned Catherine Hayward, but there's also Catherine Rembert.
Yes.
And the women and the men that they trained.
And do you know this sort of obscure fact, that I think one reason why the university administration was supporting the development of the art department is that they wanted to increase the enrollment of the university and to attract women to the university. And so they thought they could do it through the vehicle of an art department.
Oh, I'm not surprised in the least. Well, because you do include art teachers as artists, and Hayward and Rembert are both very famous, Lynn.
And there are several of the women artists featured here, and of course in the directory, who not only were formally trained in art at colleges, I think especially of Converse College in Spartanburg, mm-hmm. which trained Blundell Malone and Margaret Law. Margaret Law would then go on in her hometown of Spartanburg to be the superintendent of art for the district schools. There's Mary Leith Thomas, who was instrumental in the Atlanta area and Athens, Georgia area school district. So several of them did go on pursue undergraduate and then graduate degrees at Southern institutions, female colleges and co-ed institutions, and then go on to be instrumental and influential teachers. The cover artist Teresa Pollock is one such example. I mean, she was associated with VCU for decades.
And excuse me, Susanna.
I was going to say, building on what Martha said about the Southern States Art League, how important these different clubs and organizations were for women to really find a voice. Josephine Cooper and Margaret Law founded the Spartanburg Arts and Crafts Club, which ultimately became the Spartanburg Art Museum, which I myself benefited from as a child and which really sparked an interest in art that led me to pursue studying art history in later years. And I just feel that those organizations were really important for women in those times. And following my time at WNL, I actually worked for the Cooper Union in New York City, and two of the artists featured in Central to Their Lives, Augusta Savage and Helen Turner, were both alums of the Cooper Union. So it's just really remarkable that how these women all had different career paths, whether they teach art, make art, advocate for art, and how it really has all come full circle in the lives of so many Southern women.
Martha, one teacher, and I would say that's why she's included, would be Georgia O'Keeffe, who taught briefly at Columbia College. But for her, she had an artistic epiphany in Columbia that really changed the course of her life.
Exactly. And I think that's a powerful kind of reversal of things. I always love to quote a statement she wrote to Anita Politzer, and she talked, quote unquote, hibernating in South Carolina is something everybody should do. And the point was that she could dig into her work, that there weren't any distractions, there weren't any colleagues. So she turned inward and created this incredible body of work, which really laid a foundation.
And so in defining who Southern women are, the net was cast fairly broadly. We did the same thing for the encyclopedia.
Yes, and
actually,
remember?
I know, but actually there was a Georgia O'Keeffe quote that we discussed, and it's not where I was born, but it's what I've done where I was that are basically, you know, what did I do there that was
right.
important,
right.
not where I just happened to be dropped into the world.
Right.
And so that brought Georgia O'Keeffe, that was your argument for putting her
mm-hmm.
in the encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. This is something that, you know, I ask authors all the time for their favorite passage. But Susanna, I'm going to start with you and ask you, of all of the women in the book, who is your favorite and why?
As I mentioned earlier, my parents were really inspired with collecting the art because of the sense of place and where they were from that the art gave them. And so for me, it would have to be Margaret Law. I love her paintings of scenery in and around Spartanburg and the Peaches and the work that took place there, and particularly living in Denver. Now I have several pieces by different Southern artists in my home, and it just gives such a sense of home and a sense of where you're from. And Margaret Law is so representative of Spartanburg County, where I was fortunate enough to grow up.
Martha, could you describe the painting that she was talking about?
Certainly. It's called Peach Shed, Inman, South Carolina, which, of course, is in the upstate, not far from Spartanburg. It's an undated canvas of good size, and what we see is a peach shed, very colorful foreground, kind of a sandy yellow, and we see a worker carrying a big bushel barrel of peaches into this composition that is defined by several dark, they're not really arches because they're not round, but several very geometric shapes. Very colorful, which I think is very typical of her work. I think this is one of the best examples that she's ever did.
It's actually one of two paintings that you have in the book with a peach market as the scene. And one of the images that really grabbed me as I went through, I'm not saying it's my favorite, but since we've already got one peach market, was Winona Day Bell's peach packing, which was set in Spartanburg County, 1938.
I think another thing that's interesting about both of those paintings is that it really does show how Southern artists were connected to broader American movements in art at that time. You know, both kind of connected to that American scene, regionalist movement in both subject matter and feel. Certainly Laws is more impressionistic, but the I think, Martha, you confirm or deny, but I mean, Bell's work, it harks of Benton and Curry in that sense.
And I think one could say that in a microcosm, these artists reflect national trends. Perhaps maybe there's a little bit of a time lapse. In other words, the welcoming of a kind of abstract expressionistic style is well past the heyday of the big guys, and I'm talking Jackson Pollock and that group. But nevertheless, the responses of people like Ida Kollmeyer out of New Orleans, or Dusty Bonger, or Edith London, they're all kind of refreshing and I would say very personal interpretations of abstract expressionism rather than imitative.
I think the story of Bell in itself it's fascinating. She's from Trenton, South Carolina. She went to Bernal College, fine. But then she studied at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. Then she studied in Paris. Then she studied in Italy over the course of almost two decades. Now, that's just I find an incredible trajectory for a young Southern woman in the years right around World War I. These biographies that you have, the many biographies with the artists, to me, they're as fascinating as the paintings themselves.
Anne Goldthwait's another great example of that trajectory, Walter, I think. You know, she's deep in Alabama growing up and has this abiding interest in art and obvious talent. And it's only after she, quote-unquote, fails to find a mate after making her debut that her family encourages her to move on. her opportunity having been missed, evidently, in Alabama at that time. And she goes to New York. She then goes to Paris. She lives at the American Girls Club, which, talk about bold in that day. She's in Gertrude Stein's circle. And then she comes back to New York and teaches at the Art Students League for several decades. One of the earlier long-term faculty members there and was a strong advocate for women's rights, women's suffrage.
And wasn't she one of the small number of women who were commissioned during the New Deal days to do murals for public buildings?
In the South. And I think that's an interesting, I was going to bring that up, is that because of the administration in Washington, Edward Rowan in particular, it was a very, first of all, male-oriented viewpoint, and then a very kind of northern. Rowan liked to work with his network of accepted artists. But because Goldthwait had a reputation that was a New York reputation through her teaching at the Art Students League, I think she was the first woman to do so, she was acceptable to him. So she did two of the what we call WPA murals. And I think that's worth thinking about, too, is that with both Winona Bell and Goldthwait, while they were working in the North, their imagery was drawn from their roots, from the South. In the case of the painting that's represented in the exhibition by Goldthwait, it's a portrait, so it doesn't really suggest Southern, except that the subject of the portrait, Francis Green Nix, becomes the director of the Montgomery Museum of Art. So there is this, through the subject matter of the portrait, there is a Southern connection.
Martha, we haven't asked you for your favorite yet.
I'm not going to answer.
I'm sorry, that is not an answer.
You'll have to take it. Curators do not choose their favorites. I never have.
What about in terms of biography, life story, somebody forgotten that you think really should be out there?
All right. Just off the top of my head, I'm going to choose Minnie Evans.
Okay. And tell us about Minnie Evans.
Minnie Evans. She painted these wonderful, mystical, often very symmetrical images, very colorful, small on paper. She was an untrained artist, unschooled artist, very much influenced by Mother Nature. She was a gatekeeper at a park. She was African American and painted these very upbeat, colorful, they're often mask-like images in the faces. People have tried to pinpoint her influences, but it just doesn't work. It's a total strikeout. She's one of several very strong African-American women in the collection. Another artist whose life story I like is Selma Burke, and she sort of falls in with other artists whose parents did not approve of her pursuit of art, and so she was forced, if you will, to take a nursing degree rather than pursue her passion for art. In the Johnson Collection, there's a wonderful sculpture by her of a woman. And I think it's worth mentioning that in the exhibition, there's several very fine examples of three-dimensional work. Selma Burke was masterful in terms of her handling of wood. Her selection of wood often kind of determines the subject matter. Perhaps her biggest claim to fame is the fact that she created the profile of Franklin Delano Roosevelt that is on the dime. And why was Selma Burke selected? Eleanor Roosevelt had a hand in that selection. So just to say that I think it's worth mentioning that there are these appropriately talented African-American women included in the exhibition.
All right. Lynn? Can you answer the question?
Well, it is a Sophie's Choice sort of situation, and it's difficult. I'm an avid reader, and so I'm always drawn to the story and the biography. I think I might choose Alma Thomas, another African-American artist who's represented in the collection, in this exhibition, excuse me, by a representative work, Still Life with Mandolin, but whose perhaps a more signature work, Blue Ground Stripe, is illustrated in one of the companion introductory essays. But Alma Thomas was born in Columbus, Georgia, near Columbus, Georgia. Her parents were middle class, and they had four daughters, Alma being the oldest. And her parents realized that in the early 20th century, Alma's and her sister's opportunities for education would be limited. So they relocated to Washington, D.C. Alma became the first graduate of Howard University's art department. She then went on to have a long career as a teacher in the district school system, all the while pursuing her art, and was quite pivotal to African-American art in that city as a principal in the Barnett Aiden Gallery. She would, after retirement, broaden her artistic horizons, paint more diligently, take advanced classes, and work in the color field painting for which she became so known. She, at the age of 80 in 1972, she became the first African-American woman to be accorded a solo exhibition at a major American museum, the Whitney Museum. And her story, I would say she was one of the better known African American artists in this exhibition, but and yet it doesn't ever reach the level that perhaps her male counterparts would have been accorded at that time. Thankfully, when the Obamas were at the White House, Michelle Obama selected one of Alma Thomas's beautiful works to hang, I believe, in a dining room, and that reawakened interest in her career, and there's been some more recent scholarship about her because of that.
when we talk about fame, I come back to Anahad Huntington, at least for our listeners, maybe in South Carolina, better known because of her work with Green Gardens. There are two of her works here in Columbia. It's an interesting story as well.
I think you're kind of opening up an opportunity to talk about what women did besides making art. So we have Anahad Huntington with the resources of her husband, Archer, formulating Brook Green Gardens. We have the women of the Charleston Renaissance feeding and fueling the preservation movement of Charleston. Verner in particular was very active in that respect, but Smith as well, Anna Hayward Taylor, with through their books and through their imagery, providing all this fodder for tourists who are coming to Charleston, which in turn led to the preservation movement. We have women who were very strong in terms of establishing museums, for instance, Marie Hull in Jackson, Mississippi. You have, and I've forgotten her first name, but Telfair, the woman who left her property in Savannah to become the Telfair Museum of Art. Mary Telfair, maybe? I'm sorry about that.
I have to go back to that thing.
That's a slight.
Mary Telfair.
Mary Telfair. So women were operative beyond just the, you know, idea of being in their studios and making art. You've already talked about teaching. And, of course, teachers leave this wonderful legacy. So teachers teach students who become proficient in their careers who might teach.
Since you've opened that up, Charleston and the Charleston Renaissance, the arts in all respects are flowering, and women are full participants in what's going on, whether you're talking about the Society for the Preservation of Spirituals, whether you're talking about the Poetry Society. Charleston, between World War I and World War II, was a pretty incredible place. You've got Laura Bragg as director of the Gibbs.
No, Charleston Museum.
I'm sorry, the Charleston Museum. Excuse
Helen
me.
McCormick was the director of the Gibbs for a while.
And I actually knew Helen McCormick.
Yes.
And you had people like the late Anna Rutledge, who studied art, went to the American Philosophical Society. In fact, they published one of her works on artists and the life mm-hmm. of Charleston. So, I mean, you've got these women participating in a very wide sphere of activities.
And that was being replicated in southern cities, large and small across the South, especially in the early 20th century. I think Deborah Pollock's essay about the strength of women's clubs, Susanna noted that earlier, the way that both artists like Margaret Lahr, Josephine Cooper in Spartanburg's case, or Marie Hull in Jackson, and then people who weren't gifted with artistic skills but had the love and passion or perhaps the organizational expertise to be advocates. You think about Mary Dwelly and the Mitt Museum in Charlotte. That cohesiveness, it then becomes fitting for us from the collections perspective that we are not intentionally so, but happily so, of all-female staff, led by a female CEO, and that success is very gratifying.
And I think it's worth mentioning another essay in the book by Evie Tarano about suffrage and women artists in the South. This is a whole new arena for me, and there's some wonderful photographic images in her essay. So I think if the whole package of the exhibition, the directory, the work itself, and then you add these six essays, it's a very rich package, if I may say so.
It absolutely is. And across the South, women's clubs had frequently began as literary societies or reading clubs. In many places, including South Carolina, quickly evolved into civic action, not just suffrage, but hospitals, public health, those kinds of issues. And the fact that the nexus for all of this is really the art world. Mm-hmm. The fine arts. Susanna, I brought out Anahad Huntington, and in your introductory essay, Brook Green Gardens had a pretty powerful experience on you as a young child.
Yes. My brother and I spent countless summers on Pawleys Island, and we spent many days at Brook Green and playing there, exploring, and Anna Hyatt Huntington really stands as a giant. In my childhood, my mom would always tell me about her and the work she created and really the gift that she gave to South Carolina with Brook Green. And as a South Carolinian, it's just a treasure and something that we're so lucky to have. And I'm so happy that she is a big part of this book.
Well, Alfred's giving me a sign, which is we need to sort of wind up. But I always like to have our guests' last word, if you will. And Susanna, I'm going to start with you. And sort of the general topic is, what do you hope this publication will do with regard to this idea of women in the art world?
The collection is privileged to be able to put forth this book, and with the exhibits of 7 museums in 7 states with a reach of hundreds of thousands of people over the next few years, I think it's a really unique opportunity to give these Southern women artists their due and their time to shine, and hopefully promote additional scholarship about each of these women, or further scholarship and interest in other women artists that we were not able to include in this book. So I think it's a wonderful starting off point for Southern women artists working during this time period.
All right. Lynn?
I agree with Susanna. And I think I'd like to just underscore the point that one of the collection's overarching goals is to educate people about Southern art. Great Southern art is simply great American art. And so what we seek to do is highlight the distinction so that, with time, that distinction, or rather that marginalization, can be erased. And so we do the same here with our women artists. We want to showcase their lives, their works, their talents, with the hope that the legacies they leave in the material objects and in their teaching can be judged on its own merit, regardless of gender. We approach the works by African American artists in the collection in the same way. We seek to highlight and elevate, hopefully to get to a situation where they are no longer referred to as a great African American artist, but simply as a great artist.
And their works are included because their works are good, not just because they happen to be produced by a woman or by a woman of color.
Yes.
Okay. And Martha?
I would like to follow up on these two wonderful statements by Susanna and Lynn by quoting the quote that I end my essay with and kind of twist it a little bit. The quote is from Cecilia Beaux early in the 20th century, and she said, "I predict an hour when women in art will be as strange sounding a topic as the title Men in Art." So we could substitute Southern art for that, that as Lynn said, this is not just Southern art, this is American art.
And I would like to remind our listeners about something Lynn said earlier, and that is within this book is a catalog of women artists across the South, and it's on the website at the Johnson Collection.
It is.
And it is an ongoing project. So if you live in Biloxi, Mississippi, and there happen to be some women artists from the 1890s that people haven't heard of, and that's very possible, just get in touch.
Please do.
Okay. I'd like to thank Susanna Johnson Shannon for being with us from Denver for this program, Lynn Blackman, who is Director of Communications for the Johnson Collection, and as I said earlier, longtime friend and guest on the journal, Martha Severance. Thank you all for being with us today on the journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. The Johnston Collection has done a great service in collecting and promoting artists of the American South. And this particular volume, Southern Women Artists, is a sadly neglected part of art history. In addition to the traveling exhibition, which will come back to South Carolina in 2020, there is an online list at the Johnston Collection of women artists in the South. It's interactive. If you discover an artist that's not recognized, you can contact the folks and have her put on the list. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of the Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.